You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
I have come here today to make a testimony, to talk about the ground on which I stand and all the many grounds on which I and my ancestors have toiled, and the ground of theater on which my fellow artists and I have labored to bring forth its fruits, its daring and its sometimes lacerating and often healing truths. So said the great playwright August Wilson 20 years ago this month when he walked to the stage at the TCG conference at the MacArthur Theater Center in Princeton, New Jersey, and dropped a figurative bomb on the American theater with the great speech, "The Ground on Which I Stand." You're listening to a very special edition of Off Script, our podcast, and this is Rob Weiner-Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater. The speech was a seminal speech for the American Theater. It tore the lid off long simmering debates about what was then called multiculturalism and colorblind casting and the deep-seated funding inequities in the American theater. It was addressed specifically to the state of black theater in relation to American culture and economy, but the speech also served as a diagnosis for the entire theater field. And many of the speech's descriptions, if not all of its prescriptions, hold eerily true today. We're reprinting the entirety of The Ground on Which I Stand in our July-August issue, which you can also find all this online, along with a reported piece by Isaac Butler about the history of the speech and its famously contentious aftermath. There are several responses and reflections from theater artists and leaders all across the American theater to the speech and its legacy. There's an interview with Wilson's widow, Constanza Romero, who also controls his estate, that I was happy to do myself. But this podcast, I wanted to focus specifically on one of the central areas of his agenda, which is sometimes brushed over quickly in debates about colorblind casting and the impact of his work and the diversification of major institutions, and that is the state of black-run theaters, which Wilson saw as essential artistic homes where black artists and artists of color could make both a life and a living and sustain their work and their audiences. Now, famously in the speech, he cited the statistic that out of 66 Lort theaters in existence at the time, only one, Crossroads Theater of New Brunswick, New Jersey, could be called a black-run theater. Today, those statistics are 72 Lort theaters and zero black theaters, though I should note that Crossroads is still around, just not at a Lort theater anymore. And there are a number of black theaters around the country in various varying levels of budget size and history. So I decided we should interview a few of those across generations of artists. So today's podcast includes an interview with Lou Bellamy, the founding artistic director of Penumbra Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, in dialogue with Jonathan McCrory, who's the director of theater arts at National Black Theater here in New York City. But before I get into that conversation, we have the extraordinary privilege to play for you 10 minutes of August delivering the speech from 20 years ago. This is fairly early in the speech, after which he has talked about the various grounds on which he stands, which includes the Western drama, the Greek Aristotelian theater, and the Black Power movement that he grew up in the 60s. He talks a little bit about funding and economic disparities in both the theater and the culture broadly, and then he says this.
The problematic nature of the relationship between white and blacks has for too long led us astray from the fulfillment of our possibilities as a society. We stare at each other across the divide of economics and privilege that has become an encumbrance on black Americans' ability to prosper and on the collective will and spirit of our national purpose. I speak about economics and privilege, and if you will look at one significant fact that affects us all in the American theater, is that of the 66 Lort theaters, there is one that can possibly be considered black. From this, one could falsely assume that there aren't a sufficient number of blacks working in American theater to sustain and support more theaters. If you do not know, I will tell you. Black theater is alive, it is vibrant, it is vital, it just isn't funded. Black theater doesn't share in the economics that it would allow it to support its artists and supply them with meaningful avenues to develop their talent and broadcast and disseminate ideas crucial to its growth. The economics are reserved as privilege to the overwhelming abundance of institutions that preserve, promote, and perpetuate white culture. This is not a complaint. This is an advertisement. Since the funding sources, both public and private, do not publicly carry avowed missions of exclusion and segregated support, this is obviously a glaring case of oversight. Or perhaps we, the proponents of black theater, have not made our presence or our needs known. I hope here tonight to correct both of those oversights and assumptions. I do not have the time in this short talk to reiterate the long and distinguished history of black theater, often accomplished amid adverse and hostile conditions, but I would like to take the time to mark a few high points. There are and have always been two distinct and parallel traditions in black art. That is, art that is conceived and designed to entertain white society, and art that feeds the spirit and celebrates the life of black America by designing its strategies for survival and prosperity. An important part of black theater that is often ignored but is seminal to its tradition is its origins on the slave plantations of the South. Summoned to the big house to entertain the slave owner and his guests, the slave began a tradition of theater as entertainment for whites that reached its pinnacle in the heyday of the Harlem Renaissance. This entertainment for whites consisted of whatever the slave imagined or knew that his master wanted to see and hear. This tradition has its present life counterpart in the crossover artists that slant their material for white consumption. The second tradition occurred when the African, in the confines of the slave quarters, sought to invest his spirit with the strength of his ancestors by conceiving in his art, in his song and dance, a world in which he was the spiritual center. And his existence was a manifest act of the creator from whom life flowed. He could then create an art that was functional and furnished him with the spiritual temperament necessary for his survival as property and a dehumanizing status that was attendant to that. I stand myself and my art squarely on the self-defining ground of the slave quarters, and I found the ground to be hallowed and made fertile by the blood and bones of the men and women who can only be described as warriors on the cultural battlefield that affirmed their self-worth. As there is no idea that cannot be contained by black life, these men and women found themselves to be sufficient and secure in their art and in their instructions. It was this high ground of self-determination that the black playwrights of the 60s marked out for themselves. Ron Milner, Ed Bullins, Philip Hayes Dean, Richard Wesley, Lonnie Elder III, Sonia Sanchez, Barbara Ann Teer, and Ameri Baraka were particularly vocal and whose talents confirmed their presence in the society and altered the American theater, its meaning, its craft, and its history. The brilliant explosion of black arts and letters of the 60s remains for me the hallmark and the signpost that points the way to our contemporary work on the same ground. Black playwrights everywhere remain indebted to them for their brave and courageous forays into an area that is marked with landmines and the shadows of snipers who would reserve the territory of arts and letters in American theater as their own special province and point blacks toward the ball fields and the bandstands. That black theater today comes under such assault should surprise no one, as we are on the verge of reclaiming and reexamining the purpose and pillars of our art and laying out new directions for its expansion. And as such, we make a target for cultural imperialists who seek to empower and propagate their ideas about the world as the only valid ideas. Robert Brustein, writing in an article/review titled Unity from Diversity, is apparently disturbed that, quote, there's a tremendous outpouring of work by minority artists, end quote, which he attributes to cultural diversity. He writes that the practice of extending invitations to a national banquet from which a lot of hungry people have been excluded is a practice that can lead to confused standards. He goes on to establish a presumption of inferiority of the work of minority artists, and I quote, funding agencies have started substituting sociological criteria for aesthetic criteria in their grant procedures, indicating that elitist notions like quality and excellence are no longer functional, end quote. He goes on to say, quote, it is disarming in all senses of the word to say that we don't share common experiences that are measurable by common standards. But the growing number of truly talented artists with more universal interest suggests that we may soon be in a position to return to a single value system, end quote. Brustein's surprisingly sophomoric assumption that this tremendous outpouring of work by minority artists leads to confusing standards and that funding agencies have started substituting sociological for aesthetic criteria, leaving aside notions like quality and excellence, shows him to be a victim of 19th century thinking in the linguistic environment that posits blacks as unqualified. Quite possibly, this tremendous outpouring of work by minority artists may lead to a raising of standards and a raising of the levels of excellence. But Mr. Brustein cannot allow that possibility. To suggest that funding agencies are rewarding inferior work by pursuing sociological criteria not only serves to call into question the tremendous outpouring of plays by white playwrights who benefit from funding given to the 66 Lord theaters in this country. Are those theaters funded on sociological or aesthetic criteria? Do we have 66 excellent theaters? Or do these theaters benefit from the sociological advantage that they are run by whites and cater to largely white audiences? The truth is that often where there are aesthetic criteria of excellence, it is the sociological criteria that traditionally has excluded blacks. I say, raise the standards and remove the sociological conditions of considerations of race and privilege, and we will meet you at the crossroads in equal numbers, prepared to do the work of extending and developing the common ground of the American theater. We are capable of the work of the highest order. We can answer to the high standards of world-class art. And anyone who doubts our capabilities at this late stage is being intellectually dishonest.
So that was the excerpt from August Wilson delivering his speech, The Ground on Which I Stand. And now I'm going to talk about the speech and some of the issues raised by it, specifically around theaters of color, with Lou Bellamy, Penumbra Theater, and Jonathan McRory of National Black Theater.
I feel like I've been living with this speech just in my, you know, for my critical armchair since I was have been in this business. And then recently just in putting together this package, republishing the speech, and I've just been really sort of living with it and contemplating it. I wonder if you could both start out by telling me your history with this speech. You can also talk a little bit about your history with August if you want, but with the speech specifically, what kind of impact this had on you in your career as an artist and an administrator leader?
For me, this is Jonathan.
Jonathan McCrory, yeah.
So for me, the speech, there are two different experiential elements to it. There's one where it's part of your lived history. I think there's a powerful incantation being done inside of the speech where August is really talking about the blood memories that many Black and Brown people are having to manage in a system that was designed to sometimes oppress and not to liberate the consciousness of an individual. I actually re-listened and reread the speech last week. And when I first read it, I think it went over me. I think my consciousness wasn't there yet. I think it was like high school, and it wasn't necessarily a part. It didn't vibrate with me in a certain kind of way, right? And when I re-listened to it, I got really clear about progress and about the lack of progress. I got really clear about the areas and spaces where we have yet to allow for liberated voices from the African diaspora, but of people of color in general, to be at the center of conversation, of support. And when you're talking about institutions, right? When you're talking about institutions, and he's talking about there's only one in the canon at that time that would be considered esteemed enough or just to based off those values, I call into question the idea of where are those values placed now? When we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, those are the new buzzwords.
Right.
And we talk about who are the institutions that we're funding for that diversity and inclusion? Who are the institutions that we're trusting with that work? Who are those institutions that we are allowing to now claim that they are the leaders of diversity and equity and inclusion? And how are we negating a history of many other theaters, theaters of colors, mid-sized theaters, theaters who have been doing this legacy work for many years? How are we not allowing for them to sit at the center and be celebrated for their work and not be demonized for the lack of support that they have actually been given over a course of period of time? There becomes a deep erosion of possibility when you are consistently being defunded, when you're consistently not being considered a peer, when you're consistently being neglected because you're seen as that you can't play with the big boys, right? And that doesn't allow for you to actually dream and manifest. There's a lot of complicated, nuanced conversations that are happening inside of his speech, inside of the words that he has woven together, that I think we're still wrestling with, that we still haven't addressed as a community, as a Black community, as a community of theater practitioners, as a community of human beings. And on the heels of such a horrific event that even that happened on Sunday, it's just like we are still pitting ourselves against this vile capitalistic nature of trying to fit into a box, like how the stacks of cards, the decks of cards have been sometimes played against us. Instead of creating alternate realities, we're trying to play inside of that reality, and how that is detrimental to us when it wasn't necessarily created for just to honor or celebrate us. So that's my initial thing. I know I rambled for a while.
No, that's fine. You covered a lot there. Lou, you've been doing what you do longer than, you know, before the speech and then since the speech. And I know August worked at your theater on his early plays as well. If you could talk a little bit, respond to what Jonathan raised, but also just your response to the speech.
Yeah. I think that Jonathan is feeling and experiencing a lot of the same things. And what that should tell us is that this is not an individual or regional issue. This is an issue that is much wider than that. And August attempted to address these inequities, if you will, as I, and it's been a while since I saw the speech or heard him give it, but I talked with him as he was preparing it and knew what was going on about it and what he, sort of what he was going to cover. We produced his first professional production, a play called Black Bart in the Sacred Hills. And to understand Wilson, one has to understand the Black Arts Movement as well.
Right.
He was, as he used to say, fired in that kiln. So those tenets of the Black Arts Movement are fueling him. They are, they're allowing him a firm foundation upon which, as he would say, he's standing in his grandfather's shoes, that it was his perspective from a viewpoint that the Black Arts Movement had given him. And as I remember the speech, it was primarily on two levels. One was a financial or funding level that, that was certainly there and still is an issue. And the other level was more of a craft or cultural level that talked about the way in which this work is created, who touches it, who has the expertise, the knowledge and the ability to do the work well, to supply the cultural nuance and intent of a playwright. So those are the two levels that I see him talking about. First, this this cultural level. African American culture is designed in many ways to obfuscate, so that people looking at the culture outside of it don't see it all. They're only allowed to see what people want them to see, sort of. And I always think of Paul Laurence Dunbar's speech, "We wear the mask that grins and lies, that shields our face and hides our eyes. Let them only see us while we wear the mask." And so that's there. And when we have major regionals, might as well say white theaters, because that's what they all are, producing this work, they can have the effect of homogenizing the work, pushing it towards center, misinterpreting nuance. Black folks are complicated. Believe me, I've been studying them a long time, and they are complicated. So there's that issue. And August firmly set down a line that said, this is where I reserve the right to interpret my own culture. I know it. I can do it. I can do it lovingly. You see, if you look, I'm talking too long, I know.
No, it's fine. But, yeah.
But if you view African American culture looking for the pathology, that's what you're going to see, because it is there.
Sure.
But if you view it looking for its beauty and with love, all of a sudden these people open up for you, and it's absolutely glorious, and everyone wants some then.
Yeah.
That brings us to the financial or the economic part of his argument as well, which was that the Black theater is alive and well. It just isn't funded.
Yep.
And we still have these issues that began. The worst example I can think of was that Lila Wallace initiative.
Okay.
That almost closed cultural institutions up. They would give major regionals, you know, a million, and this is still going on.
Yeah.
The Guthrie just got $1 million here to do cultural work. We haven't, you know, we don't get that same amount of support. So while we grow the art, we almost, if we're not careful, and I wrote an article on this about the same time August and I and many other people were thinking about these issues, colorblind casting, all sure. that crap. And I talked about us, these cultural institutions, developing the work, training the people, and then that talent gets creamed off.
Yeah.
And the cultural institutions don't get the benefit of doing it. As soon as it can be monetized, commodified, commercialized, they don't have control of it anymore.
Right, right.
And it's a recipe that fortunately the culture is so strong and powerful that it keeps bubbling this stuff up.
Right.
But it's we're not doing anyone a good service by surrendering it. And it is even more solidified, codified now when white directors, many of them white females, are gaining relationships in the major finishing schools with black playwrights.
Right.
So that before I even get to see them, I can't. We used to have a playwriting development wing, but it had to go because we couldn't get the funding for it.
Okay.
So we're losing those playwrights while they're still in graduate school.
Well, no, I was just going to say there is an insidious financial burden that's now on the art field, yeah. from the individual artists to the institution from wide different perspectives, because now artists are going to grad school is costing more, college is costing more in general, and what has been and in the bandwidth of that, theaters of color and particularly black theaters have not been able to expand the financial capital that's necessary to meet that need. So instead of being able to get the newer playwrights, per se, the hotter playwrights, and have them come through our doors, they are looking and there's this love affair also when you're talking about the new age of art and artists in my generation. There's a love affair with celebrityism.
Sure.
And a love affair with what is sexy.
Right.
And what is sexy is not so much my culture, per se. What is sexy is that dollar bill that I need in order to make sure I can pay my rent. There's also this very conflicting nature of there's a veneer on blackness and when it comes to black theater. And I say that in a way in which that there is a veneer in the fact people don't expect... Like, it's hard to get support. It's hard to get the financial capital unless you don't get it until you're about to close. Like, if you're about to close, then you become valuable and important. But if you are doing if your doors are open, you don't get the type of support that's necessary so that you can excel and exceed.
Right.
It's just like, oh, they're okay. Oh, they're fine. And until they're about to close, we're not going to come in and try to swoop up and try to protect them. I mean, there's a real fact. In 1986, when the Black Arts Movement was happening in New York City, there were 200 black theaters. 200 exactly. black theaters in New York City at that moment. Now you are barely able to find 200 black theaters around the country.
Right.
So when August was writing on the ground in which there was an abundance of black theater. There was an abundance of opportunity. Not to say he was writing it in 1986, but when he was coming into his being, when there was a populace of theater happening in his era, there was an abundance of theater, and it might not have been seen as legitimate to some, I put quotation marks under that,
right,
to
sure.
some just viewers, but it was happening inside the community. Now you have very few theaters that are able to withstand the test of time and really hold weight to this new economic engine, these new economic desires and needs that need to be met by artists of color. And you also have what Lou was talking about, this appropriation of narrative and art and talent where black artists are not necessarily working with other artists of color.
Right.
And they're working with other artists, white artists in particular, because they want to be able to get into the house.
Right.
They want to be able to get into the Guthrie. They want to be able to get into the house because they have been sold a idealistic notion that to be in the house is to be successful. And that if I have to sell out my culture, I have to sell out I'm not trying to say all artists are doing this, right? But there is this kind of insidious prevailing nature of many black artists, because I will say for MBT, and I'll speak from our from the vantage point in which I occupy.
Yeah.
My door is open to many artists. I work with a ton of different artists, and I also have a hard time getting people to actually want to work with MBT at the exact same time because they don't see it as that legitimate space, right?
Right.
And what I'm consistently having to do is to change that narrative and change that perspective so that they actually value our participation inside of what we can provide for them and also the legacy which we can give and what legacy they're participating in, which is a little bit beyond what money can provide, right? But at the same time, I'm also having to deal with this very real nature of, in order for me to be able to expand capacity and expand what we're able to do, there has to be an influx of financial capital. And where is that financial capital coming from when, as I know I'm about to go in circles, but as I'm going back to the fact of as these hot topic words of diversity and inclusion are popping up, many of that funding is not going to help to sustain the institutions that have been doing the work, that many of that funding is going to sustain or to create new programming in institutions that have now had the capacity because they have a development team to create a program that allows for it to seem sexy.
I'm following along with you. We're experiencing the same sort of America right now.
Yeah.
What worries me even more is that not only are we losing touch with these writers and sometimes actors, directors, and so forth, but this pressure that is exerted, and you can't blame a writer for hooking up with Tina Landau so that she can get his work done. I mean, I understand what is happening, and it was subtle, and it's becoming even more pronounced, is that you can begin to see writers writing for these different institutions rather than writing for an African-American audience.
Right.
I remember when Carlisle Brown was not produced at all, and he brought me his play. We premiered a lot of his work. Little Tommy Parker's celebrated colored minstrel show. It ended in a lynching.
Right.
And he had shopped that to major regionals all across the country. And they said, we will do it, but we don't like that ending.
Yeah.
You know, and when he brought it to me, I said, man, I'll do that play. That's exactly what I think, you know, would go down. So you're finding people starting to fill those expectations, for instance, harping on dysfunction and pathology. Black playwrights not finding or feeling the need for a black theater. I've heard a couple black playwrights actually say that.
I mean, the thing about in his speech, he talks about the 66 Lort theaters at the time in 1996, only one could be called a black theater. And he was talking about Crossroads. Now, Crossroads is still
which
around.
Which went down right after that.
Right. I mean, it's around in a form now, and it's not Lort anymore. And now there are about seven. I checked. There's about 72 Lort theaters now, and you know there are some culturally specific ones in there, but there's not a black theater among the Lort. Now, Lort's just one measurement, and I'm just wondering, maybe looking back 20 years, how you if it's about how you measure success, and how you measure size, and if you change that measurement, whether you could say that culturally specific theaters or black theaters are doing better or worse than they were 20 years ago?
Clearly, they're doing worse. There are less of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say this. I will say that black theater is in a very unique precipice. And the simple fact that, see, you know what's so interesting? I think it's extremely interesting. And I think integration was a bag of goods that actually was detrimental to the black psyche. Okay. And I will say that that's a very I know it's probably a very traumatic thing to say.
But
I will say that because we integrated into a system that didn't honor our full being, we also wanted to always be in the room, in like as we say in Hamilton, the room where it happens, where we think that it's happening. And yeah. instead of feeding the spaces where we were authentically given royalty, we were authentically challenged to be whole and our spirituality and our in our blackness, we fleed from those spaces to get into spaces that we were not allowed to because we wanted to be, i.e. in the room where it happens. Right. And so in doing that, many of our brightest, and I can't fault them, because there's also this very much insidious nature that happened within the black theater legacy, where many of our brightest were not being supported, right? Because they weren't considered, their work wasn't considered black enough. There was a moment where there are a lot of black writers who were not being given the space to be their quirky self. And so then inside of a black company's lexicon, so then therefore okay. They went to other spaces in order to own or be able to have a space of autonomy. But I will also say that, but to go back to the idea of integration, is that, and this is my hypothesis, I have no proven theory, because many theaters, Eurocentric founded theaters, do not do many plays by Asian Americans, many plays, they might start, and with LTC, they probably will start doing this, many plays by Hispanic Americans from that lineage. There is this real sense of, I'm going to work within. I'm going to support the organizations that are founded in my likeness, that support my likeness. I'm going to contribute my artistry to those organizations. I'm going to contribute my social capital to those organizations so they can grow.
Right.
For many black organizations and institutions, that type of commitment is not necessarily there. It used to be there when you had your Ruby Dees, your Ozzie Davises, when you had your Harry Belafonte's, when you had your August Wilson's, right? You had people who had social capital, and because they knew their social capital had weight and validity, would make sure that when they went to do that Oscar-winning movie or that Tony or whatever, that they would also take that same energy and put that same type of commitment into a black institution or to an institution in their community that needed that type of spotlight in order to be able to excel.
Right.
Again, when I look at the ground in which we are standing in, and when you talk about what you were just saying, there are no black theaters who are Lord right now. I think some of that has to do with this false notion of what integration did. This false notion of instead of feeding the well that is authentically in my likeness, that celebrates my likeness, I'm going to go to spaces where it looks more attractive and where right. I wasn't allowed to be in.
It is even more detrimental than even you described, and that was pretty dismal for me to hear. Those institutions that during integration invited sort of blacks away from their own institutions, and their own institutions died, went away, and the larger major white institutions didn't wholly accept all of them. So the people are left bereft. Their institutions were destroyed by integration, and the white institutions did not provide for them in the same kind of way. So it's sort of a double whammy.
And then what we have, which is why when you listen to his, when you read or listen to his essay again, you have a moment that I feel like now where you listen to what he's saying and you are almost like, we didn't move. Where did we go?
Yeah.
Where did we go? And what you have is that you have a resurgence. I think there is, I don't know the exact term of it, but this generation, you all are a part of it, not just me because I'm younger, but this generation that we're living in, this era that we're living in, is an era of spiritual awakening, right? And inside that space of spiritual awakening is a asking for a deep meditation on self-love, a deep meditation on honoring who you are and honoring the space in which your purpose or your curiosity was driven from. And as we are being horrifically kind of reminded of the violations to our humanity from what happened in Orlando to even the situation, I don't mean to bring this up, but the situation with Trump, the situation that's happening in Chicago every day, like the atrocities that are happening against not just black and brown bodies, but just bodies in general, is a wake-up call to return back to a source called love. Because and for me, this is what helps me to sleep at night, really. The only way that I can affirm that is by saying that I see so many of my community members, when atrocities like that happen, wanting and needing to come to MBT just to breathe. Needing to come to MBT just to say hello and get a hug. That is a currency that is beyond the beyond. You know what I mean? It reminds me of why I have to keep the doors open, why I have to make sure the ground in which this institution stands on is so fertile, so rich, so professional, so clear, so attractive that I create a foundation that is unmatched and that is able to become a beacon for this community, for the nation, for the world. I really do think it's unfortunate that as many years as the ground in which I stand started from, do not have, we should have a black theater that is like Ailey in New York, a space that is crafted from authenticity of the African diaspora, that is able to be palatable, but also radical for everyone to have a seat at the table and ask us to fall deep and a deeper sense of love within ourselves. And I think that we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity. And I think with this next generation of leadership, this bearing of torch that's happening within leadership, this nexus of ideas and thoughts, that we are coming towards a precipice of something exciting, but something that will radically create oases inside of this burning building called integration.
Wow.
I think that you've got your finger on the pulse of what is going on. I think that, and I've not said this nationally to, and you broached on it, Jonathan, because I don't like to give negative criticism of the black community very much publicly. I talk about that stuff as family stuff when I talk about it. But there are studies that say Michael Kaiser is doing, where it shows that these cultural institutions, black ones are the ones that I know, get to a certain level and then freeze. It's about $3 million. And when they get there, they have exhausted all the public, private funds, the foundations and corporations and that sort of thing. And then they stagnate because we have not been successful in maintaining that group of people that Jonathan was talking about, those Ozzie Davises, those Ruby Dees, that would constitute an individual giving base. That's the part we don't have.
Right.
But now, my question for you is, does a theater need to go beyond that, or can it succeed by being a smaller incubator? Or do you feel like there, like you said, there needs to be the equivalent of an Ailey or like
Of course, you know, you can, artists use their own measuring sticks.
Sure.
But it is embarrassing. It's horrific that with all the black talent in every segment of creating a play, from playwriting to lighting to directing to set, that we have been unable to maintain a regional or a major institution that has all the bells and whistles and allows people to create inside of their own cultural community this work that is good, powerful, honest,
right,
story-fulfilling.
I agree with you, Rob. I agree with you on the simple fact that, like, my lane is my lane, right?
Yeah.
My lane and my ecosystem in this ecosystem is important. And if I try to go beyond that lane of that ecosystem, right, whatever that might mean, that's when I get into disaster, right? But, and when I look at, like, a place like NEC,
yeah,
and I look at historically where NEC was on the trajectory to be.
It's a Negro Ensemble Company for our listeners, but go on, yeah.
But when I look at the trajectory of where it was meant to be, or where it was and where it is now, and I look at the dichotomy between the two, and yes, I'm about to romanticize it, and it's not as romantic as I'm about to make it, right?
Sure.
But when I look at the dichotomy between the two, I see something where in which I'm like, there was a huge missed opportunity. There was a beacon that was being formulated that, because of whatever X, Y, and Z, right, didn't actually sustain its building, didn't actually sustain its opportunity within legacy, and didn't right. wasn't able to become a formidable force to make sure that it churned out consistently the type of artist that it was creating. And right. There are many examples of that within the history of Black theater and throughout the country. Like, you could say Crossroads was on the trajectory to be that.
Right.
It's like these beacons of light are formidably positioned and anchored to become these channels that allow for us to have a national platform that is an equitable foundation and at par with our fellow white European institutions.
Right.
And the challenge is that in 2016 we don't have one. We don't have one. And because we don't have one, many of our artists who are seeking to find spaces that allow for their dreams to be manifested with unlimited budget,
right,
quote unquote, yeah, they are also following suit and then doing an exodus outside of spaces that are authentically crafted for them, which makes it difficult sometimes to, again, remind yourself of the value. You know what I right. mean? It's just like, I tell people this all the time. The moment, because I'm 30 right now, the moment that I have gray hair, I have bags underneath my eyes, and I'm talking about I have to at least be 35, 36. The sure. moment that those things start to accumulate on my body, I'm not willing to sacrifice my soul and my body for this thing. My life is too valuable. What I plan on doing with my life is too valuable because I've seen my ancestors, my legacy holders, my giants who I look up to, give so much to this field that they have hardened on some level.
Mm.
And that hardening, because they have been toiling at crafting the space for the ground in which they stand to be equitable for their community, the hardening that they have experienced has not allowed for them to grow beyond the scope of understanding what they created. I hope that makes sense. But there is a legacy of people who have toiled at this for so many years, who because of being unheard, devalued, and not considered contributors to this field in an equitable way, they have pieces of their spirit have actually been chipped away, and it's right. actually done a huge disservice to what they are meant, what they could be contributing to this field. And so that's yeah. another awareness.
You're talking about a burnout, which a lot of theater folks, but especially yeah. working in smaller theaters, experience. But now you're not burned out, are you, Lou?
No, I mean, he's in many ways, he's talking about me. And I understand that. I think that in the larger scheme of things, we're expected to get tired, Jonathan. We're expected to give up. I have a very good friend who speaks of institutional racism as a rubber band that you step into and hold in the kind of a shape that will allow your culture and your art and people in. And then eventually you will tire. And when you tire and let that rubber band go, it springs back into the shape that it was before you held it. Now, that's really pessimistic. But there is a certain degree of truth to it, so much so that I tried my level best to keep my daughter from coming into mid-size arts. I told her, it will break your heart. Your eyes, your dreams will always exceed your grasp.
You keep her away, Lou.
But at the same time, I realize that that's what institutional racism, what props it up, is that people do get tired. And you've just got to keep up. August said it poetically. I'm standing in my grandfather's shoes. Now I'll walk as far as I can, and God damn it, I hope there's someone who steps into mine and keeps on walking, you know?
Yeah.
That's great. I think that's an aspiration that he would hope to pass on through the speech. That's a great place to close. I did want to I think we might just close there, but I'm going to ask one more question if you have a second, Lou. A lot of these issues about black artists who had success giving back to the institutions which nurtured them, a lot of those issues were brought up around his speech and around his own work and his own legacy. The irony, one of the ironies of the speech is that he was talking about how we need theaters, but a lot of the work that he reached the platform and the economic success that he did through largely white theaters and through Broadway productions. Now, I know you probably know as well as anyone, Lou, about his attitude toward second productions and royalties. And do you feel like his legacy as a sort of businessman, as well as this, as a leader with his speech, was also to give back to the community? I know that you also talked about he had that he called that meeting in Dartmouth to try and build on the institutional, you know, implications of his speech. Could you talk a little bit about that, part of his life?
Well, I think that history shows that none of these plays, although they may have been developed or begun in the hall here at Penumbra, when I used to hear him talking about stuff, none of those plays began in a black institution.
Right.
Okay. And therefore that institution isn't getting, you know, royalties or anything like that for presenting the work. But what August did do is he rather was like Harry Truman in that he got in, got a space, and then turned back around and opened up a dialogue once he had a platform that many of us never get the platform to speak from. And to his credit, when he got that platform, he began to really step forward and say some things like the ground on which I stand, you know.
Yeah, what's often pointed out that the speech is something where he didn't need to give this speech. I mean, he was successful, he was doing well by many measures, and to give this speech in itself was an act of courage and leadership, which we're all grateful for. Lou, Jonathan, it's been a true pleasure. I'm inspired by talking to you both.
Good to talk with you both.
Thank you so much.
Good to meet you, Jonathan.
Good to meet you too, Lou.
All right.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Off Script, this special edition. You can find our entire August Wilson package online. There'll be links to what we spoke about in the show page. Also, we'll see you at the conference. I can't promise a speech as incendiary or as memorable as this one, but it's going to be a great conference in D.C. this week, July 23rd through 25th. And like us on iTunes, write us a nice review, and we'll see you next time.